Hi, this is Evan Karish, Editor-in-Chief of Anesthesiology, with some highlights from the September 2019 issue as selected by the journal editors. We begin this month with a randomized, controlled clinical trial that examined the degree to which ventilatory response to hypoxia is restored after reversal of neuromuscular blockade. Dr. Suzanne Broens and colleagues at Leiden University Medical Center in Leiden, the Netherlands, conducted the study. They tested the hypothesis that the hypoxic ventilatory response would be fully restored following antagonism of neuromuscular blockade and return to a train of four ratio of one. They evaluated 34 healthy volunteers. They obtained baseline ventilatory responses to 5 minutes of hypoxia, measured at an oxygen saturation of 80%, and then ventilation at hyperoxic isohypercapnia caused by breathing carbon dioxide and an end-tidal carbon dioxide concentration of 55 millimeters of mercury. They then measured these ventilatory responses during rocuronium-induced partial neuromuscular block. Finally, they obtained readings following reversal until the train of four reached one. One experimental group received neostigmine and atropine. Another group received Sugammadex, and another was allowed to recover spontaneously. The authors confirmed that low-dose rocuronium significantly reduced the ventilatory response to hypoxia. Following full reversal, as measured at the adductor pollicis or thumb, there was persistent residual blunting of the hypoxic ventilatory response. They saw impairment in about half the subjects after Sugammadex reversal, and about two-thirds of the subjects in the neostigmine reversal group. Nearly all patients showed this impairment after spontaneous reversal to a train of four ratio of one. The authors concluded that impairment of the hypoxic response may persist despite full reversal and recovery of neuromuscular blockade. Our next clinical study investigated the prevalence of postoperative cognitive dysfunction and its association with in-hospital delirium. Dr. Lori D'Aiello of Brown University and colleagues there and elsewhere conducted the retrospective study. They tested the hypothesis that delirium would be a significant risk factor for postoperative cognitive dysfunction. They conducted an observational study in which patient interviews and chart reviews were used to assess postoperative delirium daily during hospitalization until discharge following major non-cardiac surgery, and to assess cognitive function at 1, 2, and 6 months postoperatively. They found that nearly one quarter of the patients developed delirium during hospitalization. The number of patients with postoperative cognitive dysfunction peaked at 1 month, with nearly half the patients affected. However, this proportion decreased to one-fourth of the patients at 2 months and 16% at 6 months. At each follow-up, the level of agreement between delirium and postoperative cognitive dysfunction was poor. The authors found that the risk of postoperative cognitive dysfunction was significantly increased in patients with delirium at 1 month, but not thereafter. The authors concluded that postoperative delirium and postoperative cognitive dysfunction may be distinct entities. Next, we have a randomized clinical trial that studied the ideal location for single injection adductor canal block to maximize analgesia and quadriceps function following knee surgery. Dr. Faraj Abdallah of the University of Ottawa and colleagues there and elsewhere in Canada conducted the study. They compared opioid use and quadriceps strength in patients receiving an adductor block at distal, mid, and proximal locations for an anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction. They tested the hypothesis that a distal adductor block would be superior compared with proximal and mid locations. The patients were randomized to receive either proximal, mid, or distal adductor canal injection for the adductor canal block. The primary outcomes were cumulative 24-hour oral morphine equivalent consumption and quadriceps strength decrease at 30 minutes post-injection. The authors found that, contrary to their hypothesis, the proximal, not the distal injection, decreased 24-hour morphine consumption, reducing it to half that after mid or distal injections. Quadriceps strength was similar for all injection locations. The nausea and vomiting risk was also lower with proximal adductor canal block. The authors concluded that the proximal adductor canal injection location decreased opioid consumption and opioid-related side effects without compromising quadriceps strength in patients undergoing anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction. Our next study was a retrospective meta-analysis to compare the analgesic effectiveness of pectoralis 2 block versus systemic analgesia or versus paravertebral block for breast cancer surgery, primarily modified radical mastectomy. Dr. Nasir Hussain of The Ohio State University and colleagues there and elsewhere performed the meta-analysis. As primary outcomes, they chose postoperative oral morphine consumption and difference in area under the curve for pooled rest pain scores for the first 24 hours. The authors analyzed 14 randomized trials that contained nearly 900 patients. They found that pectoralis 2 block, compared with systemic analgesia, provided clinically important reductions in 24-hour morphine consumption of about 30 milligrams and reduced rest pain. In contrast, the pectoralis 2 block, compared with paravertebral block, did not result in differences in opioid consumption or pain. The authors concluded that pectoralis 2 block reduced pain intensity and morphine consumption during the first 24 hours postoperatively compared with systemic analgesia alone, but was not different than paravertebral block after breast cancer surgery. Next, we have a study that examined the direct revenue that many U.S. anesthesia groups receive from hospitals in addition to payments for services. Chloe O'Connell of Stanford University and colleagues there and elsewhere conducted the study, noting that these direct payments may enable services to be provided to low-resource and underserved patients. They analyzed data from 240 non-academic California hospitals during a 12-year period. The authors set out to understand the association between these payments and the fraction of anesthesia revenue derived from public payers like Medicaid. They found that more hospitals made direct payments to an anesthesia group in 2014 than in 2002, and the median payment increased during that time. In addition, hospitals where public insurers accounted for a larger fraction of anesthesia revenues became more likely to make direct payments to private anesthesia groups. They found that every percentage point increase in the fraction of anesthesia revenue derived from public payers was associated with a 2% relative increase in the amount paid. The authors concluded that direct payments to private anesthesia groups are becoming increasingly important, particularly for hospitals that provide care to underserved populations. Our next study is a laboratory investigation of thrombosis and hemostasis. It used a porcine polytrauma model to examine prothrombin complex concentrates, which are an increasingly common part of bleeding management algorithms in surgery and trauma. Dr. Oliver Grotke of Aachen University Hospital in Aachen, Germany, and colleagues there and in Austria conducted the study. They tested the hypothesis that a difference in risk could arise from the plasma ratio of procoagulant proteins versus anticoagulant proteins. They further tested the hypothesis that antithrombin can modulate prothrombotic effects and prevent adverse events associated with prothrombin complex concentrates. The authors assembled 9 experimental groups of 7 animals each. In addition to a control group, 4 groups included prothrombin complex concentrates alone and 3 groups of prothrombin complex concentrates plus increasing doses of antithrombin. Another 4 groups were fibrinogen concentrate plus prothrombin complex concentrates, fibrinogen concentrates plus antithrombin, tranexamic acid plus fibrinogen concentrate plus prothrombin complex concentrates, and tranexamic acid combined with the other 3 compounds. Animals in each group received bilateral femur fractures and thorax contusion, followed 60 minutes later by blunt liver injury. After receiving their assigned treatments, animals were subsequently observed for 3.5 hours. The authors found that total blood loss was statistically significantly lower in all 3 groups receiving prothrombin complex concentrates plus antithrombin. Antithrombin protected against both disseminated intravascular coagulation and pulmonary emboli. The authors concluded that the addition of antithrombin appears to balance the procoagulant effects of prothrombin complex concentrates. Antithrombin also reduced the risk of complications without impairing effectiveness. Our clinical focus review this month explores the use of intraoperative methadone in surgical patients. Doctors Glenn Murphy and Joseph Zokel of North Shore University Health System, a part of the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine in Evanston, Illinois, note that methadone is an alternative opioid with a long half-life that provides stable blood concentrations after a single intraoperative dose. It has additional effects, specifically NMDA receptor antagonism and inhibition of serotonin and norepinephrine uptake, that may enhance patient recovery, by attenuating the development of hyperalgesia and tolerance and improve mood state. The authors report that various randomized trials have found that the use of methadone in the operating room is associated with significant reductions in postoperative analgesic requirements. Additionally, most studies demonstrate that pain scores were significantly lower in patients given methadone, while the risk of opioid-related side effects did not increase. When methadone is given induction of anesthesia, the peak respiratory depressant effect occurs while the airway is controlled, and surgical duration should allow sufficient time for spontaneous recovery of ventilations. The reason why methadone is not more commonly used in surgery may be related to misconceptions about pharmacokinetics and duration of effect, and concerns about prolonged respiratory depression. Large-scale, randomized trials are needed to more clearly define the safety and efficacy of methadone in the perioperative period. Optimal dosing regimens in various surgical procedures have yet to be determined, as well as appropriate use in high-risk patient populations. Finally, our review article this month discusses transfusion-related acute lung injury in the perioperative patient. Dr. Mark McVeigh of St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, Canada, and an international team of colleagues noted that transfusion-related acute lung injury is a leading cause of death associated with the use of blood products. Transfusion-related acute lung injury is a diagnosis of exclusion that can be difficult to identify during the perioperative period and, therefore, requires vigilance to detect and manage effectively. Anesthesiologists and perioperative critical care physicians are uniquely positioned to become leaders in transfusion-related acute lung injury due to their patient proximity and role of directly delivering and monitoring blood products. Additionally, anesthesiologists are able to arrange rapid testing and coordinate resources, care teams, and follow-up. We need increased awareness, training, and reporting of transfusion-related acute lung injury to develop an understanding of these injuries, epidemiology, and risk factors. Prospective risk scores should be developed and emerging new therapies tested. Even though prospective randomized trials for treatment of transfusion-related acute lung injury are nearly impossible due to its relatively rare incidence. More noteworthy articles await readers in the September issue of Anesthesiology. I'll be back in just a few short weeks with an inside look at our October issue. As always, I hope that this podcast and our journal help you deepen your knowledge and strengthen your clinical practice.